Support for this public radio podcast comes from Bose, offering Bose in-ear headphones designed for comfort and quality sound and featuring soft silicone tips in three sizes at bose.com/radio.
So I'm crossing the Pacific, 21 years old, on a flight from San Francisco to Tokyo. And I am keyed up. For the first time, I'm going someplace that I'm really going to stand out without even trying. I'm going to be the one who gets looked at funny and wondered about. Now, I've been studying Japanese all summer in Vermont, and now I'm on the plane, and I am ready to bust out a little bit of konnichiwa action, if you know what I'm talking about. Now, I don't suppose there's any perfect icebreaker for that person in the seat next to me. And my language skills at this point are still very much in the developing stage. But still, you know, I wish I could have started off my great cultural adventure with something other than, "So, you're Japanese?" Yeah, it still makes me groan just a little bit every time I think about it. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. This woman who was next to me on the plane handled my sad attempt at conversation so gracefully, I think we probably talked for about an hour. I don't know, of course, how much ground we actually covered during that time, but I think she deserves a lot of credit for the year that followed, because I kept trying to belong there as best I could. It's fun to be an outsider, for a while, but in the end, that was no match for the competing urge. That urge is so strong, so undeniable, that even in a place like Japan, where I know I will never really fit in, I'm never going to fool anybody into thinking I'm Japanese, a person will put incredible effort into that pursuit. We can't help it.
Looking at evolution, I think it's about proving that you're part of the group so you get the protection. I mean, I think it's quite ingrained in us on a very basic level.
I think we're pack animals.
I think people have the ultimate desire to be not in conflict with the environment.
Now, we're going to hear later in the show from a woman who is quite literally at every moment in conflict with her environment. Similarly, for immigrants to the U.S., fitting in can become the defining activity of your life. But we all fight that battle to some degree. Harmony with our surroundings, the balance between being true to ourselves and the comfort of having a place in the world.
On the farm, I was the city kid, and then I'd go back to California, and I was that weird kid who talked about bean walking and tractor pulls.
Bean walking, whatever that is. Of course, you know, fitting in doesn't just mean rounding off your edges to please the crowd.
I guess I can be accused of trying to fit in by being the person that doesn't want to fit in.
I go to a lot of science fiction conventions. Like, there are rules in science fiction geek culture that you have to know and follow or you don't really fit in. All these people who don't fit in just made a new normal that they could fit into.
Tonight's episode is called Finding Your Fit. Now, that's a pretty darn big topic. And because we do have to fit this episode into about an hour, we're going to focus it down a bit. We're talking, for the most part, about the experience of fitting in with dominant culture, that mainstream world around us that must be reckoned with whether we want to or not. For example, how does a diverse face acclimatize to a new company? Can you ever really feel at home in a new country? What if society dictates that we all be men or women, but you're not sure you're either one? And we'll consider what it is in our genes, in our background, that makes fitting in so imperative. Our house band, The Smarts, is with us, of course. We've got commentators and interview guests waiting in the wings. And as always, we've got our audience here at Minnesota Public Radio. So, whether you're joining us on the podcast, on the radio, or here in person, thank you, everybody, for fitting in an hour with In the Loop. Now, the task of finding your fit begins as soon as we're tossed into the sandbox. We're not going to have to go back quite that far, but we do have some young people, seventh graders, as a matter of fact, to help launch us on our way tonight. First up is Michelle Verdugo. Hey, Michelle.
Hi.
Michelle is 12 years old from Sheridan Middle School in Minneapolis, and thanks for taking the time to write a little something for us. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us your story?
An experience of me not fitting in would be when I first came to Minnesota from New Jersey. I felt like I was born again because I had no friends, no knowledge of where I was, and sometimes of who I was. I first came to my new school near the end of fifth grade. I was surprised nobody seemed to really want a new friend. I felt unhappy, invisible, and like I couldn't be myself because I was scared of what people might say. In order to fit in, I stopped being scared and shy. I was going back to being myself. This happened when I met my best friend. She had confidence and was nice. Then I got 4 more really good friends in 6th grade. Since that day, I learned I should always be myself and just hear but not listen to any mean comments. Now I'm in 7th grade and I'm not afraid to express myself or say what I think.
That's Michelle Verdugo. Thanks, Michelle. Now we have another student from Sheridan Middle School. This is Ivy Dierling. Ivy, thanks for coming on In the Loop. Go ahead and tell us your story.
A time I felt I didn't fit in was last year in 6th grade. I had long hair, and I wanted to change that, so I cut my hair into a mohawk. After my hair was cut, I discovered many people didn't like it. It didn't bother me because that was their opinion, and anyways, it was too late to go back. I had promised myself that anything anyone said wouldn't hurt me. It took a while for my friends to get used to the mohawk, but now I have even more friends, including my friend Rachel. We were close before I cut my hair, but afterwards we became closer. I think that was because with my mohawk, I stuck out more. We get along great because, like me, she is different from other people. I am happy I made that promise to myself. Now I feel even more confident about myself, even though I always have been.
That's Ivy Dierling. Now, Ivy, quick question for you. Somebody told me that your mom gave you a hand with that mohawk.
Yes.
Not everybody's mom would do that. That's pretty cool, mom, huh?
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on the show. Last, we've got one more 7th grader, this time from Marcy Open School in Minneapolis, with a poem this time. This is Louisa Lincoln. Hey, Louisa.
Hi.
Now, you wrote this in class just the other day for us, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're very glad you did. Let's hear what you got.
Fitting in. It stinks being new. The teachers always introduce you. How embarrassing. It's horrible being new. You're lost. Nobody will help you. It's torture being new. You go unnoticed. Nobody talks to you. It's embarrassing being new. Everybody looks at you, not in a good way. Then finally, somebody says, hi, sits by you in class. You're not so self-conscious anymore. Somebody to help you with homework. You fit in, finally.
Thank you. That's Louisa Lincoln. Seventh graders all. Now let's dwell in childhood a little while longer with Jake Scott. Jake is a listener who wrote to us about his experience with our topic tonight, finding your fit, and he can certainly identify with the girls we've just heard from. Jake, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Now, I understand you grew up yourself as a bit of an outsider.
Yeah, I always sort of straddled that area between fitting in and not fitting in.
What were some of the things that set you apart?
You know, the usual stuff, acne and childhood obesity and extensive pet reptile collection.
The usual stuff, of course. Well, how did things work out for you and the lizards and snakes?
It was all right. I was eventually able to find a way to fit in using a sense of humor. But I had friends who weren't so lucky.
Yeah, why don't you tell us to start off with about your friend Steve.
Sure. As far as I was concerned, Steve was the funniest person in 3rd grade. He was also the ultimate misfit. He kind of had this dorky haircut, and he walked funny, and he was always doing just bizarre things. One of my first memories of Steve was when he took 2 Crayola washable markers, gave them the names Eric and Susie, then proceeded to act out a steamy love scene between the two on his desk until the teacher saw what he was doing and sent him to the hallway for a timeout. Steve was so awkward that the other kids could hardly help but make fun of him. So he created the Thieves Guild. The Thieves Guild was a top secret club where Steve was in charge. He decided what we did and who got to be involved. I remember when he called me to invite me to the first meeting. When my mom answers the door, you have to tell her the secret password or she won't let you in. The secret password Steve chose was Schwarterfish because, according to him, swordfish would be too easy for someone to guess. The Thieves Guild was an awesome club. We met every Saturday afternoon to play Super Nintendo, read comic books, and plan pranks. Soon, more kids wanted to join our club, even some popular ones. Eventually, the Thieves Guild grew to 9 members, and inside the club, everyone thought Steve was cool. In the Thieves Guild, there were no misfits. Now I'm a 3rd grade teacher, and I definitely have a couple of Steves in my class. They are the kids who drive the other teachers crazy, but they're my favorites. They just make going to school so much more interesting. Last year, a student transferred into my room. Let's call him Jared. And right away, I could tell he was going to have trouble fitting in. Jared would draw these elaborate pictures of flying toilets attacking cities, and he would make all sorts of weird noises during class. And on Mondays, when I asked the kids how their weekends were, he went on these wild tangents about fighting babies. The kid was definitely odd, but he was a great artist, and he was really funny. I wanted my other students to see their new classmate the same way I did. I wanted them to appreciate his differences. So I asked Jared to draw something for me to hang behind my desk. The next day, he handed me a 12 by 18 picture of me being attacked by a giant red flying fish. The other kids saw the picture hanging in the classroom, and they loved it. Soon, everyone was saying that Jared was the funniest person in our class, and gradually, all the other boys started drawing toilets and fish and fighting babies. But there are a lot of other Steves in my class, and not all of them can find a way to fit in, no matter how much I try to help them. Some of them have just been misfits for too long. Hopefully, they'll get through their awkward stage, make some good friends, and find their place. I only wish that, in the meantime, they could have a Thieves Guild of their own.
That's Jake Scott. Thank you, Jake. Here on In the Loop, I'm Jeff Horwich. Listeners like Jake, who submit ideas and commentaries to help us build the show, are part of what we call our Public Insight Network. The more folks we have in it, of course, the more great material we have to work with. You can learn more about how that whole thing works at minnesotapublicradio.org/in-the-loop. Now, from Jake's third grade classroom, we're going to make an entirely logical jump to the jungles of Tanzania. Michael Wilson is here with me, and when he's not in those far-flung jungles, he's teaching biological anthropology at the University of Minnesota. Michael, thanks for coming by.
Thank you very much.
Now, Michael's been studying primates and baboons in Africa for years, and especially chimpanzees, since about 2001. So, Michael, this is the crux of why we're bringing you here for this show tonight. On the one hand, I think our impulse to fit in, you know, we'd like to tell ourselves that that's very superficial. But, you know, from studying our closest relatives, what, from what you've seen, makes fitting in so imperative, you know, on a biological level?
Well, fitting in is very important, and as primates, we're very social creatures. The other members of our order, the baboons and chimpanzees and the other monkeys and apes, are very social creatures by and large.
What are the various things that, you know, being a part of the group offers you, you know, in the chimp world?
Well, in the chimp world, being part of the group, for one, that's where your mates are. Also, the males in particular defend a group territory, and they keep males from other communities from coming into their territory, and that provides benefits to those chimpanzees within that territory. The females and their young have food, and that's very important for them to grow up, for the females to produce offspring. They need food. So that group territoriality is something that's very important for chimpanzees and is something that people do as well.
What happens if you're a chimp who doesn't fit in somehow?
Well, it's very difficult, and they also leave their groups if they're female adolescents, which is very interesting listening to the young girls talking
about
the
female adolescents we have on the show tonight.
Exactly, and a chimpanzee at about that age would be just getting ready to leave her group, female chimpanzees, in order to find a group in which they don't run any risk of mating with their dad or their brother or some other male relative. They need to go into a new group, and that's a very stressful time.
Well, give us an example of what you've seen. I remember a particular story along those lines, right?
A really striking example is the story of Shweeney, who is a young female from the Kasekela community. And this is in Gombe National Park in Tanzania. It's the group of chimpanzees that Jane Goodall began studying in 1960. And Shweeney, when she was 10 or 11 years old, started going into the Mutumba community to the north, looking for a new place to live. And when she got there, the day that she happened to go, she didn't have a sexual swelling, which is something that female chimpanzees, when they're adults, they have these big pink swellings on their bottoms that advertise their sexual state.
As unusual as that looks, it helps you fit in.
That's right. But unfortunately, Shweeney chose to go on a day when she didn't have one of these. And she found a group of Mutumba chimpanzees, a few males and some females. And the males were very happy to see her, though maybe not as happy as if she had had one of these swellings. And the females were very unhappy to see her. And whenever they got a chance, these females attacked her. Then the males would hear the screams, and they'd come running, and they'd chase off their own females and groom Sweeney. But eventually the males would lose interest because she didn't have a swelling. And so they'd wander off, go looking for food, and the females would see their chance and attack Sweeney again. This happened all day long. Eventually she gave up. She went back to Casa Kayla with a gaping wound on her head. Her scalp had been exposed down to her skull. She had, you know, bloody marks on her fingers. You know, she had really been beat up. And yet it was so important for her to find a new place to live that she kept trying. She went back to Matumba a couple more times before she finally gave up and just settled in Casa Kayla.
And is there any survival without a group as a chimp?
Absolutely not. Without a group, you can't defend a territory. And if you do run into members of another group, which is bound to happen eventually, if you're a male, they'll try to kill you.
So how much of what you're seeing in chimps do you believe explains human impulses?
Well, we're very similar to chimpanzees. We're also very different in lots of important ways. But like chimpanzees, it's very important for us to belong to a group. And for most of human history, we lived in small groups in which everyone knew each other. And being a stranger was very dangerous.
Michael Wilson, thanks very much for giving us a very interesting angle on our topic tonight.
Thank you very much.
On In the Loop. Now, one thing about being a chimpanzee, you know what the norms are. You know what you're supposed to fit into, what kind of things you're supposed to do. Chimp culture doesn't change very much. In human culture, American culture, there's something pretty interesting going on right now. Thanks to all kinds of forces, technology is a big one, our cultural references are getting more and more diverse. Remember, even 10 years ago, I mean, it seemed like everybody was watching Friends, right? Think about that today. Is there really a parallel? We're entering a bold new media world. And when you think of it in the terms of our show tonight, you can't help but be a little bit nostalgic.
Back in the day, I was so on the ball, in tune with the rest of my friends. What's hip and what's happening, I knew it all. Ride the crest of those fashions and trends. In the past, it had just seemed so easy to tell what was popular, how to fit in. And I always knew how the prevailing winds blew. Now I don't even know where to begin. I used to know just what to watch on the tube so I could chime in at work the next day. Now our pop culture is so damn diffused. On our breaks, no one knows what to say. You know, 9,000 channels for all kinds of people. I just can't keep up at this rate. If you don't watch Sopranos, The Office, or Idol, how the heck are we supposed to relate? To be all of us like the same bands. Now the internet has ruined my world. Why does the only mass music these days seem designed for a 12-year-old girl? I loved how I could feel part of a crowd when the DJ told me what was cool. Now, liking the same stuff that other folks like, I guess somehow that makes me a tool.
In fact, I think the kids now they're doing it up a half step or so. So let's give that a shot if you're ready, fellas.
Well, I guess I'm supposed to do research and forge my own tastes, but I'm not sure where all of this ends. I feel like my efforts are going to waste if it don't help make me some friends. Take it! All watch the same nightly news, have the same papers dropped on our stoop. Things that we heard that we all knew in common, they made us feel part of the group. With all the new choices, it's harder to tell just who my compatriots are. My sense of community is going to hell. At least we still have NPR. Woo! I know that you've got your blogs and your chat rooms, some virtual Second Life place. Never thought I'd put in quite so much work for a club I won't meet face to face. There's no common language for culture these days. Somehow, it just feels kinda wrong. The long tail has changed things in so many ways. I'm just not sure where I belong. Woo!
Thank you very much. You're listening to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. We're listening to our episode tonight called Finding Your Fit. Of course, that is the Smarts helping me out on that tune. We'll hear more from them a little later in the show. As we move ahead, we're going to hear from a number of people for whom fitting in becomes essentially a life-defining activity. Our first gateway into one of these stories is Paku Heng, who is with us tonight. Listeners here in St. Paul might recognize the name. She ran for city council not long ago. Paku, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jeff.
Now, Paku's family background is Hmong. So tell us just a bit about the Hmong population here in St. Paul.
Sure. In the Twin Cities, the Hmong population is about 40,000 to 60,000. The census has that range. It's always a little bit of a discrepancy. But it's probably the most progressive and dynamic and politically stable community in all of the United States.
Now, you yourself came to the U.S. in 1976. You were just days old. But our ears perked up when we talked to you, and you said you'd been wanting for some time to talk to your mom. Why now, especially, were you finding that you wanted to have a conversation with your mother?
Well, two things really happened. In 2004, I was able to go back to Thailand, where I was born, and so much of the mannerisms and the personalities of the people in Thailand reminded me of my mom and my dad. And then right around that same time, the youngest child in our family, there are seven kids in our family, and the youngest one graduated from high school, and she was getting ready to go to college. So I was really curious how my mom was going to weather this next stage in her life.
So you had sort of a challenge with terminology in getting ready for this conversation, right?
Right. When I was asked to ask my mom about questions of belonging, I had a real struggle because in the Hmong language, there isn't one word that has the same type of connotations or denotes the same type of meaning as we have in the English language. And so when we began to ask my mom these questions, I remember some of the manifestations of in Hmong would be, you know, mom, where are the places or the moments where you were your most happy? And trying to use those images and feelings to denote the kind of meaning or definition we think of when we think of belonging.
So you took the opportunity to ask some questions of your mother just this week, as a matter of fact. We sent our producer, Larissa Anderson, along to catch some of that. So let's listen for a few minutes here. This is Paku Heng with her mother, whose name is Pua.
Mom, you've lived in Laos, in Georgia, in Rhode Island, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota. Which places have you been the most happy in, and which places have you do you think that they have been the most accepting of you?
I feel that I am most at home here because I can go and participate in elections every year. I felt most at home this fall when I was able to go to the polling because my daughter was running for city council. And to me, that was sort of the best representation that I truly belong here. It's my house, it's my home, it's my country.
You know, when they lived in Georgia, they were like the only Hmong people there. Minnesota had the most Hmong people. And so I think it's very interesting for her to say that this is the best place and the place that she feels like she belongs the most. And when you juxtapose that with the fact that, you know, the Hmong community is the strongest here and that are the most like economically stable, that have the most inroads to political life. So I think that shapes then a person's sense of belonging. Mom, do you remember when we lived in the house on Hall Street and there was that family, the German family next door, and how they circulated a petition to have us move from that neighborhood? What were you thinking when that happened?
When we were living in Hall, we were probably one of the very few, if not the only immigrant and Hmong family that's moved into the neighborhood. And so it was clear that they have not seen a whole lot of diversity and was very hostile to us. I felt as if I was betrayed because here I was thinking that America was a dream. It was a land of opportunity and that everyone would be welcome. We felt that we weren't safe even with our neighbors next door. And so at that time, I felt sad.
I thought her answer was really interesting, you know, because I didn't feel betrayed. I felt like a sense of injustice, but I could see where she would feel betrayed then, you know, especially being, you know, an immigrant and really believing that idea of America as the land of opportunities.
Mom, you've lived in this country for over 30 years now. How does that change your, you know, your sense of identity or your sense of yourself?
Genetically and in my DNA, I know that I'm Hmong, but I've lived here for more than the time that I've spent in Laos. And so I feel more Americanized. I feel that my skin looks different, but in every way, is very much of I'm very much of an American, of a Minnesotan, and for that I'm very proud.
So in the early 1970s, the United States and the Hmong community in Laos allied, and many Hmong soldiers were asked then to patrol parts of the Ho Chi Minh Trail and to help rescue fallen American soldiers. When the Vietnam War ended, many Hmong families in the Hmong community were targeted in Laos. My father had been a captain in the Royal Lao Army, and so my parents fled in the middle of the night.
I miss Laos, of course, because that was where I was born. But I also understand that the circumstances in which I now call America my home is such that it was in a time of war, and it wasn't as if I had a choice to move. I was forced to move. And so, of course, while I embrace America, I still very much miss my home.
I will be totally honest. I think that my mom and my dad really don't have the luxury of reflecting and feeling like they belong, because they had very young children and they had to take care of their family. They didn't have a choice whether they belonged or not, whether a certain place wanted them or not. They had to forge a life for their kids.
So we've been listening to Paku Heng talk to her mother, Pua, with Sister Kaying helping to interpret there. Our producer, Larissa Anderson, put that together. So we're back with Paku now. And I want to ask, how much of your mother's sense of belonging do you think is her actively trying to fit in? How much of it is the community adapting to her?
We have a very vibrant Hmong community here, and I think that St. Paul and the Twin Cities has been very open and welcoming, but they've also been greatly changed and accommodating of the different immigrant communities here.
You were raised in the U.S. Does it ever feel to you like there's any part of you that doesn't fit here?
Well, I definitely think of myself as a Hmong American. You know, when I dream Hmong. But at the same time, I watch American Idol. We eat turkey at Thanksgiving. So I feel like those things make me American. And then certainly, as I was kind of alluding to in the interview, I have the luxury to be able to ponder whether I fit in or not. And I think that's a very American attribute, because we have so many privileges here and opportunities here that my parents certainly didn't have when they were farmers in Laos.
Well, Paku, thanks very much for letting us into your family and into your conversation. Paku Heng. Now, just about any of us going to work someplace new are going to be in for an adjustment. For some employees, and in some offices, there's a bigger challenge than for others. And if a good employee doesn't fit in, it's the company that pays the price. To keep that price to a minimum, they can turn to people like our next guest here on In the Loop, Val Jensen. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
A little bit about Val. She's the executive director of Twin Cities Diversity in Practice. Her specialty is law firms. You're a lawyer yourself, right?
Yes, I am.
And her group also includes legal departments at some very big companies, 3M, Best Buy, Target, General Mills. They're all trying to attract, and they're trying to keep, most importantly, attorneys of color.
Yes.
So, let's face it. I mean, Minnesota is not the most diverse place in the country. I think our law firms and our companies probably reflect that. So what's going on in these workplaces? What's happening there that makes what you do necessary?
There's a realization now that you have to provide more than just a good job. If you look up and you don't see anybody who looks like you, or even in the office next to you, then you start to feel kind of isolated. And even though you love your work and there's good quality work, what is your life like outside the job? Where do I go to get my hair cut? Maybe I'm a Latino and I want to go to a Spanish-speaking church. How do I find that? What these firms are realizing is that, you know, the challenge is not only can I give them good work, but what community are they coming into?
What is the real dollars and cents cost for companies who don't pay sufficient attention to this?
To bring in a lawyer and to train them for 2 or 3 years and then have them leave, the cost is somewhere between $250 and $500,000. And so when you think about the fact that every time a lawyer of color leaves...
And we don't just have to talk about law firms here,
I guess.
We're talking about any type of business management.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You have spent that time, that effort. Oftentimes you've paid relocation fees. It's a high economic cost.
What are the cautionary tales here? Some examples of where somebody has come to a firm or a legal department here in Minnesota and they feel like they don't fit. Is it in the cultural references, talk around the office? Give me some examples.
Absolutely. I've worked in law schools, and I did a lot of work with recruiting young law students of color. And, you know, I'm from Minnesota, born and raised. You know, I think it's great. So, you know, everybody in my family hunts. You know, it's hunting. Everybody hunts. And I had an African student, and I said, oh, you should come up north with us, you know, and see what it's like during hunting season. And so we came up, and everybody's wearing orange. He said to me the most interesting thing. He said, you know, if you dropped me down into the middle of this hunting season, and I was like an alien, I would think, God, Minnesotans are really weird. Everybody wears orange. Just things like that. Or at my high school, hockey was a big sport, you know, and they even had hockey cheerleaders. I went to college and people are like, hockey cheerleaders? I mean, what? You know, and I was like, yeah. And they're like, black people play hockey? And I was like, well, no, not really, you know, but
that's not deliberately exclusionary. It's just the kind of thing that you feel like it's not you.
Right, absolutely.
And so your advice is trying to make law firms, first of all, aware of that, I guess.
Absolutely.
What should they do? To make that person feel like they can identify with the firm.
You know, a lot of the corporations, I think, do a good job of what they call onboarding. You know, when you get to the job, connecting you with a mentor, but not just a mentor who's going to say, okay, you know, to be a good lawyer, you do X, Y, and Z. It's a mentor who maybe pulls you aside and says, how is it really going? Two of my most important mentors have been white males. It's because they've taken the time to know me and to help me. But I think if you can have those meaningful relationships, then you're going to be able to say, you know, jokingly, you know, yeah, hockey's not my thing.
Well, as you said, I mean, you're a woman of color.
Yes.
Do you feel at all like you don't fit when you go into some of the firms that you work with?
Absolutely. For instance, I used to be a prosecutor in Ramsey County. And every time I went to court, at least one person would go, oh, so are you the court reporter? Or are you the, you know, the assumption is not that I'm the lawyer. The assumption is that I'm the court reporter or the support staff. Or those are constant reminders that you might not fit in and that people see you as differently.
Well, Val Jensen with Diversity in Practice, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fortunate for us that we ran into Val along the way. Let's bring the lights up here and talk a bit with our audience here in the UBS Forum at Minnesota Public Radio. I want to focus, first of all, on our obligation to help people fit in. Has anybody ever gone out of their way to try and make that happen? Oh, yeah, right over here.
Hi, my name is Paul Lewis. I'm from Stillwater. This is a story from back in high school once. I knew how it was to be the new kid in a school. There was this one kid sitting at a lunch table all by himself. And, you know, looked kind of bummed out. You know, I went over there and introduced myself and said, hey, why don't you come over and sit at the table with, you know, us? That worked out pretty good. And then I started dating his sister. And that's when things started to go downhill. It was a good experience at first. I think he appreciated it. And then he got kind of part of the cool group and blew us off.
But you gave him a leg up.
Yeah, absolutely.
He sort of leapfrog over you on his way to the top.
You're right.
What is it about that experience, though, of all the things you have happened to you during school? I mean, it seems like a relatively small thing. Why do you think that sticks with you? You still remember it today?
I guess it's something that I felt I was proud of myself for extending, you know, my hand to somebody else to try to make them feel better than perhaps I felt one other time in my life.
Thanks. Let's broaden our view a little bit and just think about whether, as a culture, as a society, if we're getting better at this. Are we becoming more welcoming? Yeah, let's go right back here.
Dan from Maple Grove. I can definitely appreciate liking to have a group of friends that are diverse, but That definitely gets me into trouble in certain situations. When I see somebody that stands out, somebody from another country specifically, oftentimes I'll go up and I'll ask them a lot of questions. But more often than not, they'll be more uncomfortable listening to my questions or wanting, you know, my prodding than feeling accepted.
So efforts to reach out and try and make somebody feel welcome.
Yeah, oftentimes it makes them feel more left out.
We have all these notions about, you know, what we should be doing. The goals are there. We're all out trying to act on those goals. Maybe that's just a little weird sometimes. Let's get into our own experiences before we wrap up here with fitting in, feeling left out. Anybody ever really just been in a situation where, maybe kind of like I was going into Japan, you just knew it was never going to happen? Yeah, right here.
My name is Mike from Lakeville. I was laughing at your story about Japan because you're about the same size.
So quite right. I was, for the first time, and maybe the last time in my life, in a place where I was pretty much average height.
So there was nothing that fit me. I'm much bigger than anybody in Japan. I couldn't buy any clothes. I mean, there was no bed that I could sleep in.
And how long did you live over there?
I was there for about half a year.
Did you ever adapt to that? Did your mind sort of come to peace with your situation?
Not really. I mean, everybody I talked to asked me how tall I was, how much I weighed. I mean, I had... and I felt like... I felt really concerned because I don't feel like I'm the average American, but I felt like I was really representing America over there in everybody's mind that I met because I was so different. They would always ask me, do Americans like this and do Americans like that? And I couldn't really come up with an answer as a representative of America because we're so diverse.
Thanks very much for jumping in. Do we have one more of these you want to grab before we move on? Yeah, just give your name and where you're from.
Hi, I'm Parna from Minneapolis. I would say that Minnesota is a hard place to belong to. That is, I think that this, in some ways, it's like Japan. I mean, I think that this is a very closed society, I would say. I'm not from
Elaborate,
here.
If you would. Everybody in the room is curious.
Well, let's see. So I am not from here. I grew up in Hawaii. I don't know. I guess, you know, this whole kind of thing about Minnesota nice, I do think there is something to it. That is, there's a way that people are incredibly nice and they'll help you. But getting beyond that, I think, is actually rather difficult here. I think people are pretty closed off. I think it's pretty, I don't know. I think it's pretty hard to belong here.
Before we let you go, have you got a specific example that you can leave us with?
When I started my job, one of the things that really struck me was everyone was incredibly friendly in the work environment, but no one would ever actually invite me to their home. And there's a way that inviting someone to your home is actually really a way of actually extending that sense of you belong in our community.
How long did it take for that to happen?
Well,
has it happened?
You know, it happened, I think, more with people who weren't from Minnesota. Look, I'm sorry to offend if I'm offending anyone here, but I have very few friends who are native to Minnesota, I would say. And that's in part because I think it's very difficult to be friends with people from Minnesota.
I don't know how much of a surprise that is to many people from Minnesota. I think they might say that as well. Thank you, Parna, for speaking up. For everybody in the audience who jumped in, let's hear a little bit from the Smarks.
Shaving off my corners, trying to fit a square in a round hole, softening my borders, trying to take the curve out of the bowl. Shaving off my corners, no idea where I should begin, though I chip away as much as I may, I still just don't fit in. Dust rag. living off my corner. So if they'd widen the hole, then I could just be me.
That's the Smarts, everybody. That's Joe Weissman on bass and vocals, Jimmy Kennedy on keys and vocals, and Morris Engel on drums. More about them at thesmartsband.com, if you like. You're listening to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. For some people, fitting in goes beyond just shaving off your corners, as the band was saying there, and finding your niche in society.
When I was growing up, we didn't even have a vocabulary for who I was. Transvestite was about the only thing even expressed, and that didn't even come close.
That's Barbara Satin. She's not a transvestite, not a transsexual. She is transgendered, is the term. Producer Sandin Totten interviewed Barbara. So what does it mean, Sandin, to be transgendered?
Well, the simplest way to explain it is the gender you're born as doesn't feel like the gender you are inside. So in Barbara's case, she was born as a man, but all her life she felt like she was really this woman inside.
Okay. So transgendered, right, can apply in various situations.
Yeah, it's sort of an umbrella term for people whose gender identity is complicated. And for many of them, it's not an easy life to live. In fact, when Barbara Satin started going out as a woman, it wasn't just different. It was dangerous.
I knew that I had this inner secret, which was that I'm transgender. If anybody found that out, all of the good things in my life would just disappear, that it'd be shattered.
Back then, being transgender was thought of as perverse. She worried it would cost her job, her relationship with her family, even her safety. At the time, Barbara was part of a social club for transgendered women. They would meet to talk and trade tips on makeup and clothing, but they had to keep it all secret. The meetings were never advertised. You'd hear about them through word of mouth. The locations weren't announced until the day of the event. They were terrified of being discovered.
We went so far as to have a sergeant at arms that sort of stood at the door to make sure that everybody was a legitimate member, and if you weren't allowed into the room.
Sounds like something from the communist witch hunts of the 1950s. But actually, it was the early 90s. Today, things look a little different.
Okay, so this is District 202.
That's Ryan Lee Dahlstrom.
It's a LGBT Q U Center.
L G T B Q
L G. Hang on. There's L G B T Q.
He's showing me around a youth center for, let's see if I get this right, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or questioning teens. Whew. Basically, it's a safe space for anyone who doesn't fit your typical gender roles.
So here is kind of another hangout area.
It's part coffee house, part rec room, and part dance club. Ryan Lee works here as a youth advocate. He's like a big brother to these teens. And I use the word brother lightly. You see, Ryan Lee is also transgendered. But it's kind of hard to tell which way he's going. He comes off as either a tomboy girl or a really effeminate guy.
When I do now tell people I'm trans, a lot of people, they'll be like, well, which way are you transitioning? Are you transitioning to be a man or a woman? And I'm like, well, that's just a great question. I'm just me.
Ryan Lee says he likes occupying this space somewhere between male and female. He hopes that by blurring the lines between the two, he can show others that gender is not as hard and fast as most people think. But he runs into problems, like which bathroom to use.
Like, I had women say to me, what are you doing in here? This is the women's room, and holding their children as though I'm some freak that could harm them.
He's gotten similar responses in the men's room. Neither one is really the right fit. The same issue pops up in changing rooms, gym showers, or on applications where you have to check male or female.
I think that we just all are so ingrained. We're taught somehow that we're supposed to be just very easily fitting into box A or B, you know, M or F.
That's Max Grease. Max works with an organization at the University of Minnesota called the Transgender Commission. Their job is to create more spaces on campus where people who don't identify as male or female can feel comfortable.
That could mean having gender-free bathrooms, locker rooms, or even gender-free dorms. This may sound like overkill. After all, for most of the population, gender identity is black and white. But for those people caught in the middle, they're stuck living in a gray area.
All of our systems depend on that gender identity for some reason or another, and we just place a huge importance on it.
Systems like your driver's license, social security, hospital forms, the list goes on. In fact, there really isn't even a proper pronoun that doesn't have a sex attached to it. Some linguists say we could use words like the German Z, which can be genderless, or herm, a combination of him and her. But in reality, these words are awkward, and nobody really uses them. The problem isn't that people who defy gender are just different. It's that we don't really even have a mental category for them. Like Max says, the gender binary is really ingrained. If you don't fit box A or B, you're going to stand out. So how do you go about opening up a space in people's minds for a new definition of gender? Well, for one thing, you can start by spreading the word.
And in the wilderness blossom with flowers,
and all will see God's splendor.
See God's greatness and power.
That's what Barbara Satin does these days. She's no longer hiding. In fact, she makes a point of being seen as a trans woman. She helps lead services at her church, and she's active in her community. Today, she's standing in front of the congregation in a flashy sequined butterfly top with a long black skirt and high boots. It's all part of her campaign.
If people have no other impression of me, I want them to say, wow, she looks, or he looks, I hope they say she looks, really neat. But I also want them to go past that and say, maybe I could talk to her. Maybe I could ask her about this because I don't understand it.
So let's go back to Sandon Totten here. Sandon, does Barbara think that one day people like her will completely fit in?
Truthfully, no. She thinks society's more open to transgendered people, but at the same time, she admits that the minute you go and defy something as big as gender, you're going to stand out, and that won't change anytime soon.
Very interesting portrait. Thank you very much, Sandon. Sandon Totten. You're listening to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. When we asked for stories about fitting in, Nancy Donoval wrote us about an issue she's been dealing with for 20 years. Nancy is a communications consultant and a professional storyteller. And for that reason, you may have heard Nancy on a number of our Story Slam episodes. And given what she's about to talk about, the fact that she came out to the Story Slams is all that much more amazing. Nancy, thank you very much for coming here tonight.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to be here.
We're very glad to have you. So this is something that you deal with pretty much every moment of every day.
Yes, it's a huge part of my life.
Well, tell us about it.
I have a friend who used to start each morning by asking himself, is today a Nancy day? If it wasn't, he put on cologne. If it was, he put the bottle down. When we started teaching together, he ended up having so many Nancy days, he finally threw out his cologne and embraced having a Nancy life. Oddly enough, the phrase Nancy life is not an accepted medical term. The official name is multiple chemical sensitivities, or MCS. The federal government recognizes MCS as an invisible disability, and it really is invisible. Most people don't know it exists. It's a neurological condition that causes a person to become sensitized to chemicals in the environment. Fragrances, car exhaust, smoke, pesticides, natural gas, chlorine, air freshener, new carpet, paint, wiper fluid, Sharpies, and dry erase markers all become very dangerous to people like me. Depending on the chemical in the person, reactions can be really different. With me, it might be a migraine or an asthma attack. Cramps, nausea, sinus infection, lightheadedness. Sometimes I lose motor skills. If I keep dropping things, keys, pen, fork, it means I'm reacting to something. The scariest reactions are cognitive ones. It gets so hard to think. I lose the ability to form sentences or even words. A few years ago, I went with a friend to see the movie Adaptation. We picked our seats and settled in. I could smell some hairspray and dry cleaning fluid, but I put on my charcoal filter mask and decided to tough it out. We got lost watching Nicolas Cage play twins. Then 20 minutes in, the woman sitting right next to me started putting on lavender-scented hand lotion. We found new seats, but the damage was done. I was so foggy, I couldn't take in anything on the screen or remember it if I could. If it's that hard to go into the world, why don't I bring everybody to me, where I know it's safe? Oh, I do. But they bring the world with them. It comes in on waves of shampoo and hair gel, laundry detergent and fabric softener. Ugh! Fabric softener is the worst. It's chemically formulated to stick, and it does, to the chairs, to the couch, to the air, long after visitors leave. Even if someone wants to ride in my car, they have to submit to a sniff test first. How many changes to their lives can I ask people to make before I seem too high maintenance? 2? 5? 20? Sometimes I think, yes, please, change everything. I did. There's a safe or safer alternative for almost every product out there, except perfume. I don't think anyone has come up with a really good fragrance-free perfume. Then I think, of course it's too hard to change everything. I find it hard. Even those of us with MCS have to accommodate each other because we don't all react to the same things. Living in the world takes a ton of pre-planning. And even then, I never know what price I'll pay. Riding in a plane risks having a day when it's a struggle just to get out of bed or have a clear thought. Staying in a hotel can cost me a week. I lost a year once because of a chance encounter with varnish. I visited my family in Chicago this Thanksgiving. My brother's house was filled with the aroma of turkey and stuffing and his cleaning supplies, my sister's fresh perm, particle board, and the Scotch carded couch. After dinner, I went outside, sat in my car, and wept. I kept thinking, maybe there really isn't a place in the world for me. I remembered hearing someone talk about living in chemical exile. Yeah, we are in exile. My mom always kept her house safe for me. She's the one person in my family who got it. But now she's in a nursing home. She can't come to me. I have to go there. I choose to go there. And every time I visit, I leave drenched in Lysol and loss. I'm seeing a new therapist. He's helping me with my alienation issues. Of course, right now we're having our sessions in my car because the building where his office is got painted. It's okay. He passed the sniff test. The snow is pretty, and we have warm coats. It's just another Nancy day.
That's Nancy Donoval. Thank you, Nancy. Now, speaking of trying to find harmony with your environment, one more voice before we end tonight. Maria Diaz lives in Wilmer. That's a town in western Minnesota. It's a small city built on farming and meat processing. Wilmer's traditional Midwestern face has been augmented in recent years by people like her. Maria was born in Mexico. But she's lived in Wilmer for 15 years. This is not a new home for her. She's become an organizer in the community, putting as much effort as anybody into feeling like she belongs in this place. This is how it still feels today.
I'm trying really hard to fit in and make friends. And our way of trying to build up some friendship is I will give you my phone number and hoping that you will give me yours. And I will probably ask you to come over and eat supper with me or lunch, hoping that maybe one day you will invite me to do that. And then I'm trying to show you that I'm a nice person, that I'm opening my doors to you. And that is the beginning of a friendship. And I've tried that, gosh, many times, and it doesn't pay off. Maybe I don't know how to make new friends. Everybody's got their own circles of friends, and you don't fit in because they're full. It's like all the seats are taken. I remember my first job here in Wilmer, the same thing had happened. Everybody had their table, and I was the new person, and I sat in one, and they said, this is my spot, move. And I moved, and I went to the other table, and this other person says, this is my spot, move. Until I sat this empty table, and I was there, and that was a table for the new people.
What's amazing to hear from Maria is how hard it still is, her struggle to fit in. It may never end. Immigrants are an especially acute example. Among the folks we've heard tonight who are in large part defined by their uneasy relationship to the mainstream. But the drive to find our comfort zone to exist in harmony with the people around us, We all share this to some degree. Now, we started the show tonight with seventh graders, and certainly our childhoods are often overshadowed by the need to fit in. Anthems have been written to these difficult years. But fitting in, it's not something we put behind us as kids. It's easy for us adults to feel out of place all along the way, left out, alienated. And when you feel that way for whatever reason, just remember, In the Loop is here for you. I learned the truth at 33. Old friends had better jobs than me, with lots of money, fancy cars, and weekend trysts with movie stars. Or maybe they had families, or kids who win their spelling bees. They wheel their strollers out of view and turn around and pity you. You might not have the latest clothes, the proper weight, the perfect nose. Might not have the friends you should, the best lawn in the neighborhood. The book club lady says they're full. Adults are strangely critical. You'd give up half your spleen to be 17. You know, adults don't always fit. Be nice if we grow out of it. Think of all you know today, that they're all jerks and you're okay. You know they've all got insecurities, so fit yourself in where you please. Somewhere between death and youth, somewhere in there you learn the truth. Well, that's our program for this evening. Thank you, everybody, for listening to another hour of In the Loop. Getting folky with me tonight, of course, our house band, The Smarts. In the Loop is online at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. You can join the network of listeners who help us build the show, subscribe to our podcast, check out the Loophole blog, especially check out our new multimedia page with videos and music downloads from all of our recent shows. In the Loop is produced by Julie Seipel, Sandon Totten, and Larissa Anderson. Our interns are Bradley Campbell and Anton Fryant. Thanks to Molly Bloom, Melody Yang, Andrew Haig, and Preston Wright from Public Insight Journalism. We get multimedia help from Christina Schmidt. Our photographer is Jeremy Pavlek. Our technical director is Josh Kubasta, with engineer Maury Jensen and live producer Alan Freckman. Jim Gates is the editor of In the Loop. Our senior producer is Mark Brule. Production is supervised by Leif Bishop. The executive producer of the show is Michael Scholar. Thanks to all of our guests tonight, seventh graders on up, and of course our great audience here at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. See you next time in the Loop. Hello, this is Jeff again. Just one new In the Loop left this fall. Next week, we'll close out the season with a show made entirely of suggestions from our network, an episode we're calling The Year According to You. Tickets for the Thursday taping are pretty much sold out, I'm afraid, but you can tune in at our usual times or download the podcast. As I said, after next week, our season ends. A lot of people have been asking us, so I'll just say now, there is nothing yet planned for the spring. All of us here at Minnesota Public Radio want to know what you think of the show. So take a minute, go online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and let us know. Thanks.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.